里种。
Yeah, I'm asked to announce the sponsorship. A full day of Shiorim is sponsored by Marcia Tokaziner, Simi Teigman, and Shelly Budau, in loving member of their dearest big sister, Mrs. Temi Beck, Lili Nishmas Devora, Tama Bas Chaim Mordechai, and Nechama Leah, Aleha Shalom, on her first yahrzeit. So may all of our learning be Lili Nishmatah. I was informed by Rifki Siegel that this is actually supposed to be the last shiur until Elul. I'm not sure exactly why, but I'll follow the rules that are laid down. But, you know, as far as I know, this is it. Maybe that's why it's gradually diminishing. I don't know. People know. Anyway, I want you to talk a little bit about, as a final shiur, we just had Shavuos, and I hope it was an inspiring and elevating day of Matan Torah. I want to talk a little bit about some interesting halachic aspects that emerged from Megillas Rus that we read on Shavuos. First of all, the makor of reading Megillas Rus is not in the Gemara. As far as the Gemara is concerned, the only Megillah that the Gemara talks about reading is Megillas Esther, and that you make a bracha on. But the makor of reading the other Megillas, whether it's Shir HaShirim on Pesach, or Eicha, even on Tisha B'Av, or Koheles, on Sukkot, or Rus on Shavuos, the makor of that is a very interesting tractate that is called Maseches Sofrim. Now, what is Maseches Sofrim? Also, is not so simple. The word Maseches is normally used for Talmudic tractates, but Maseches Sofrim belongs to a genre that are called the small tractates, or the minor tractates, although they really shouldn't be minor. And this is a compilation which was probably put into final form in the time of the Gaonim. It is a post-Talmudic work, although it records many, many traditions of the Amoraim, but some of it is Gaonim. Now, the Maseches Sofrim, however, even says that one recites a bracha, al mikra Megillah, on all of the Megillahs. And as you know, this was the minhag of the Vilna Gaon, and this is the minhag in Yerushalayim, in most kihilos outside of Eretz Yisrael. The practice is we don't recite a bracha on the other Megillahs, because based on the Talmud Bavli, it is only Megillas Esther that is considered to be an obligation. For the same reason, the Vilna Gaon argues, since you make a bracha on all of the Megillahs, then all of the halachas of Megillas Esther will apply to the other Megillahs, that you have to have a cloth, parchments, and the like. And as you know, certainly outside of Eretz Yisrael, actually outside of Yerushalayim, many do not have such a custom. But be it as it may, one has to differentiate two questions. Why Megillas Rus was written and why it's read on Shavuos are two totally different questions. Why we read Megillas Rus on Shavuos? We have many reasons. It's the yahrzeit of David HaMelech, who of course is Rus's great grandson. It occurs during the wheat harvest, between the barley and the wheat harvest, which is between Pesach and Shavuos. Megillas Rus is about an individual person accepting upon herself the yoke of God's commandments, and in Matan Torah, that's what we all did. We all underwent a conversion ceremony, and Rus is the reminder of what it means to have a commitment to Hashem. That is why we connect it to the holiday of Shavuos. But why Megillas Rus was written as a book is a totally different reason. The author of Megillas Rus is none other than the Navi Shmuel. Shmuel HaNavi wrote Megillas Rus, and he wrote Megillas Rus to legitimate the lineage, the yichus of David HaMelech. David HaMelech is descended, of course, from Rus, who was a Moabite convert. And the Torahs, Ammon and Moab, of course, are the nations that are descended from Lot's incest with his daughters. right? Moab means from my father, Ammon is from my nation. And the Torah says that one is not allowed to marry the Moabite or the Ammonite, even if they convert to Judaism, because they did not give us food and water when we left Mitzrayim, and we begged them, and we were willing to pay them, and they were cruel and lack of gratitude to Avraham Avinu. So because of this, they are not allowed to enter. Now, David HaMelech is descended from Rus, the Moabite convert. As a result, there was a constant aspersion, a constant slander over his head that David is puzzled to be a part of the Jewish people because he is from the Moabites. But the halachic answer is that the prohibition of marrying the Moabite is only the males and not the females. We darshan Moavi v'lo Moavit. And in fact, we also look at the reason. The condemnation of Moab is because they did not offer us food and water. And that is only a claim against the men who could be expected to greet a foreign army. That is not a claim against the women, because the women needed to be modest and sanua. And as a result, the female Moabites are permitted. And since David comes from a female Moabite, David is a legitimate member of Am Yisrael. But the problem is that David had so many enemies, and these enemies were constantly reviving the accusation that he is puzzled because he is from the Moabite. So what Shmuel did was, Shmuel wanted to write a book to show that the marriage of Rus was approved and legitimated by the Gadol Hador, the greatest of the generation, that was Boaz. Boaz was a shofet, he was the shofet of the generation. And this is a public record. In fact, Boaz, you'll recall, married Rus in front of 10 people. And there's a machlokes. Why did Boaz take 10 people to marry Rus? According to one opinion, it's simply because Sheva Brachas requires a minyan. According to the other reason, he wanted it to be public. In those days, public was a minyan. Today we would say public requires, 1,000 people. We would look at 10 as private. But al pi halacha, a minyan is a public function, because he publicly wanted to proclaim the halacha that the female Moabite is permitted. And Boaz was a person that was held in great reverence by later generations, and therefore Shmuel wanted to record in a book of Tanakh that the marriage was kosher and approved, and therefore David's yichus is fine. So the Svarim tell us that the Megillas Rus was Shmuel's attempt to publicly affirm the legitimacy of David HaMelech's yichus. Now this explains a very interesting thing, because there is one very important detail, one would think, that Shmuel omitted from Megillas Rus. And that is, Boaz marries Rus, Boaz impregnates Rus, but he dies the next morning. He does not survive the next morning. Now, Shmuel doesn't tell you that, for very good reason. If the purpose of the book is to legitimate the yichus, so what do we have here? Boaz, the shofet, announces among great fanfare, you're permitted to marry Moabite converts, female. He marries a Moabite convert, he dies overnight. Well, people are going to say, well, that shows he made a mistake. Now, why did he die? So in truth, it really worked the opposite way. Boaz was already a very old man. He had lost his wife. Not only that, the Gemara tells us that Boaz had 120 children. Amazing. 60 sons and 60 daughters. And they all died in his lifetime. They all died. He was a broken man. He had suffered bereavement after bereavement after bereavement. He should have died a long time ago. But Hashem gave him life so that he would be able to be the progenitor of Mashiach through Rus HaMoavia, that has spark of holiness that goes all the way back to Avraham Avinu. That when Lot separated from Avraham Avinu, Lot took sparks of Kedusha that were trapped in the Tumah of Moav, that Rus and Boaz would liberate. So it's not the pshat that Boaz died because he did something wrong. It's the other way around. Hashem kept him artificially alive longer than he should have been so he could do this great mitzvah. I don't know how old he was, but was he 80? That's what he bring down? Okay, I don't know. But his time had already... She was 40. Rus was 40, yeah. His time had already come. Whatever his time was, it had already come. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was marich just for that purpose. Okay, so now I just want to mention a few things. If you recall, there was a closer relative who had the right, there were two things going on. In fact, that's a whole other kasha. This is often misunderstood. There are two different transactions that take place in the fourth chapter of Rus. One is the concept of perpetuating the seed of machlon, and therefore this resembles the mitzvah of yibum. The Torah says if a man dies without children, there's a mitzvah on his brother to marry. Now keep in mind that Boaz is not Machlon's brother. In fact, Boaz is Machlon's cousin. Basically, Boaz's father and Machlon's father, Elimelech, are brothers. Boaz and Machlon are cousins. So why is there a Yibum being discussed here? There is no Yibum here because Yibum is only a brother. So the Ramban explains that although the mandatory mitzvah of Yibum is only when there is a brother, but the concept that a relative can perpetuate the neshama of the nifter did apply to other relatives as well. And in fact, we find before Matan Torah, it even applied to a father-in-law, which is now an Erva today. In other words, because you see that Yehuda, right, Tamar, when Yehuda did not let Tamar marry his third son, so Tamar tricked Yehuda into being with her. And even though after Matan Torah that was a forbidden Erva, before Matan Torah that was Yibam. So cousins have what you might call an inyan of Yibam, a non-mandatory concept of Yibam, even though it's not Yibam Mamish. But there was a closer relative, and the closer relative, either his name is Tov, depends if Tov is a name, or his name is called Ploni Almoni, but that's not a name really. Ploni Almoni just means John Doe, etc. We use it even in modern Hebrew based on this. And he was a closer relative. He was an uncle. He was actually Elimelech's brother. He was Elimelech's brother. And Tov has the right of first refusal. But there's another transaction that's a little complicated. And that is, Naomi says, I'm just quoting the words here, that she had sold a field that she had gotten from her husband. Presumably, how does a woman get a field from her husband? She doesn't inherit. In truth, this is a field that she had collected for her kesuva when she became a widow. She had to sell it. And the Torah says, when a field is sold there in Eretz Yisrael, there's a mitzvah on relatives to redeem the field, to keep the field back in the family. Right? This is in Parshas Bahar. So Boaz first approaches Tov and says, hey, there is a field that Naomi sold, and the closest relative has the right to redeem that field, even if the buyer doesn't want to sell, but the buyer must give it. Would you like to exercise your right of redemption? So Tov says, sure, I'd love to do that. So then he says, but the catch is, you got to marry Rus. Now, simple question in pshat. Who says? I mean, Naomi sold the field. I, as a relative, have the right to redeem the field. You're telling me that I can only redeem the field if I marry Rus. Now, he doesn't want to marry Rus. We'll discuss why. Who says there's a linkage? Let him say, I don't want to marry Rus. You can do that, but I want to redeem the field. What gives Naomi the right to make a condition? So because of this, Rashi says the following. Because of this, this is a very strong kasha. Rashi has to change the meaning of machra. Machra, Naomi, does not mean Naomi sold the field. Had she sold the field, she would have no right to put a condition there. But machra means she is planning on selling the field, and as a result, she can sell it to whomever she wants, and she would like to keep the field in the family, but she will only sell it to the relative who agrees to marry Rus. You understand? This is what, now Rashi, the reason why Rashi kind of twists the words a little bit and says that machra does not mean actually sold, but it means planning on selling, because that is the only way Naomi could put such a condition in. Because once she sold it, it's out of her hands. She could not control who has the right of redemption. That would be the closest relative. So you'll recall that what the so-called Goel says is, oh, if that's it, can't do it. Lo uchal ligol li. I cannot redeem this field. Pen ashchis es nachalasi, lest I corrupt or pollute my lineage. My lineage. Rashi explains that the Goel, based on the Gemara, is ignorant of the halacha. He thinks it is prohibited to marry even a female Moabite, and therefore his children will be tainted, just as David HaMelech was accused of the tape. And therefore Rashi says he was ignorant of the halacha that Boaz established. Now, what's interesting is, Boaz makes no effort to correct him. Basically, as soon as Pliny Almoni says, can't do it, it's against the din, Boaz immediately marries her. Why didn't he tell him the din is it's permitted? So the Pische Tshuva actually brings a raya from here, that if you want to do a mitzvah, but somebody has priority in doing a mitzvah, but they think they're not allowed to do it, you don't have to correct. In other words, in order for you to get the benefit of the mitzvah, you do not have to correct their misconception. And the Gemara even says that Ploni Almoni, Almoni is a reference, you know, we use it for a John Doe, but it's a reference to being an Elam. An Elam is a mute person, a person who doesn't know halacha. He can't communicate halacha because he was ignorant. But the Brisker Rav asks a very, very excellent kasha. If Ploni Almoni thinks it is prohibited to marry a female Moabite, then why does he say, I can't do it because it'll ruin my kids? He should say, I can't do it because it's a sin. Meaning, according to his shita, it's an aveira mamish. Now, he's wrong. It's not an aveira, it's mutter. But if the source of his ignorance is, he thinks, even the female Moabite is prohibited, it's like a person saying, I can't violate Shabbos because it's a bad example for my children. That may be true, but the real reason why you can't violate Shabbos is because you're not allowed to violate Shabbos. So he shouldn't have said, I can't do this because I will taint my children. He should have said, I can't do it because it's forbidden. Yeah.
I thought it was because the din was in doubt.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who thought that really Boaz is wrong and it's both.
Right.
But I thought the whole nature of his answer was, I'm not going to take that risk on myself. You think it's right? You're the posuk ador. You've got the shoulders. I don't.
Yeah, that is a possibility. That's very much a possibility. Meaning, you're really going back to the Pisgei Tshuva. Meaning, instead of looking at Boaz as concealing information,
right,
it could very well be that Boaz made full disclosure, and the Goel's attitude still was, I don't want to take the chance, it's controversial.
Yeah,
that is a possibility. But in terms of the question, why does he refer to his children, the Brisker Rav says the following. The Brisker Rav says that there's a Rambam in Hilchos Mamrim. Mamrim is the part of the Mishnah Torah that talks about people who rebel against the Chachamim, that say the following. When the Chachamim make halacha, or they determine halacha, there are different ways they do it. Sometimes there are three different things the Chachamim do. Sometimes they make purely rabbinic enactments, like they'll enact Ner Chanukah, Megillas Esther. These are called Durabbanans. But when they're transmitting Torah laws, Doraisas, there are two different types of Doraisas they transmit. Sometimes the Doraisa is called Halacha L'Moshe Misinai. It was a direct law that was given from Moshe and handed down. There's no interpretation involved. It's a direct law that Hashem gave Moshe. Tefillin are black. Halacha L'Moshe Misinai. Tefillin are square. Halacha L'Moshe Misinai. How do you shecht an animal? Halacha L'Moshe Misinai. But then there's another genre of halacha, which is not a halacha L'Moshe Misinai, but it's based on drasha. What do I mean by drasha? Hashem gave Moshe principles of interpreting the Chumash. We'll call these, although this is not the only list, the Yud Gimel Midos, the 13 principles of Rabbi Yishmael. And the Chachamim,
what are they?
Well, it's in a sitter. I don't want to go over the 13 principles. That would take much more than one class. But these are principles through which the written Torah is authorized to be interpreted. And if you look at a sitter right before Pesukei Dezimra, of weekdays, Shabbos as well, you will see Rabbi Yishmael says there are 13 principles by which the Torah is interpreted. I mean, I'll give you two examples. One example is Kal V'chomer. Kal V'chomer means if the Torah says something in a lenient case and it's strict, how much more so in a stricter case. Another is Gezeirah Shavah. If the same word appears in two different contexts, that allows a thematic linkage. But these are called drashos. Drashos simply means the chachamim interpreting the Torah. Now it's important to understand that there's a fundamental difference between halacha l'moshe mi-sinai and a drasha. A halacha l'moshe mi-sinai is simply transmitting a direct rule that Hashem gave Moshe. Drasha is creative. We are applying Hashem's methodology, but we are creating new interpretations. In other words, we didn't hear it before, but we're looking at the Torah, and we think that this is what it means. A drasha is a creative, we talked about this last week a little bit, is a creative, dynamic application of divine principle, as opposed to a simple transmission of a divine rule. Right? And that's why we have machlokas. On a halacha l'moshe mi-sinai, there's not going to be an argument. I can't argue on a halacha l'moshe mi-sinai. On a drasha, we have many, many arguments. One chacham says that the more logical meaning of the pasuk is this. The other chacham says the more logical meaning of the pasuk is something else. And which one is right? Hashem says, Elu v'elu, divrei Elokim chayim. They're both right because they're both using methodology. Now, so we have three categories of rabbinic Torah, so to speak. We have the purely rabbinic legislative enactment, which is a takana, either a positive commandment like lighting Hanukkah candles, or a negative law like not moving muktzah. That's drabanan. That's what we mean, drabanan. But then we have actions of our sages that are actually da'oraisa. They are Torah laws, either because they are transmitting halacha l'moshe mi-sinai, or they are making a drasha. Now, is there a difference? Both are doraisa, both are Torah laws. Because when the chachamim interpret the Torah, that is the Torah, that is a doraisa. But the Rambam says there's a fundamental difference between laws that are halacha l'moshe mi-sinai and laws that are drasha based. In a drasha based law, if a later Sanhedrin, and I want to emphasize only a Sanhedrin, it doesn't mean us. If a Sanhedrin of 70 had a certain drasha, that the Torah means something, and a later Sanhedrin disagrees with that drasha, they feel that the pasuk means something else. The Rambam says a later Sanhedrin can overrule an earlier Sanhedrin on a matter of drasha, even if the later Sanhedrin is not as great as the earlier Sanhedrin. But if it's halacha l'moshe mi-sinai, if an earlier Sanhedrin says we have an unbroken tradition that this comes from Moshe Rabbeinu, there's nothing a later Sanhedrin can do. By the way, interestingly enough, the Rambam says a pure drabanan is stricter than a drasha. If the chachamim make a pure rabbinic enactment, either a positive enactment, like lighting Hanukkah candles, or a negative enactment, such as not handling muktzah. Right? One is called a takana, and one is called a gezeira.
What's the difference?
Takana is to do a positive act, and gezeira is don't do something. Make a fence around the Torah. If the chachamim make a purely rabbinic law, a later Sanhedrin can abrogate it only if they are greater in wisdom and in number. If they are not greater in wisdom and in number, they do not have the power to repeal a rabbinic enactment. And since generally the doros get weaker and not greater, it's not going to happen. By the way, the Rambam asks the kasha, Okay, I understand greater in wisdom, but what does it mean greater in number? A Sanhedrin maxes out at 71, you know, with the Nasi. So you'll never have a Sanhedrin that is greater in number. But the Rambam says, for purposes of repeal, you can add all the Chachamim of the generation and take a vote. Meaning, of course, who's going to be a Chacham? That's a good question. Meaning you can augment the Sanhedrin and expand the body for that purpose. So when it comes to a pure Durabbanan, that's where you have the rule, Gadol Mimenu B'Chachma Uve Minyan. But when it comes to Drasha-based laws, which are De'oraisa, the Rambam says even a Beis Din Katan, a Sanhedrin that is not as great, a Sanhedrin.
Of 23?
No, we're not referring to numbers, we're referring to it's a Sanhedrin of 70, or 71, but they're not as great in stature. They could be Mevatel. It's a little curious, you might be wondering, well, why should we have stricter rules for rabbinic laws than we have for Da'oraisas that are based on Drushas? But the answer actually is fairly simple. Because when you have a law based on a Drusha, the ultimate question is, what does Hashem mean in the Torah? What does Hashem mean in this Pasuk? So if a later Sanhedrin thinks Hashem doesn't mean what the earlier Sanhedrin says, then it's really Hashem against the earlier Sanhedrin, so Hashem wins. Mashenkin in the rabbinic enactment, which is not directly from Hashem, it is simply a later Sanhedrin against an earlier Sanhedrin, so they have to defer if the earlier Sanhedrin is greater in wisdom. Let me give you a secular precedent in Mamish, the same thing. That is, we know that in the United States Supreme Court, they're supposed to follow precedent, right? Earlier court decisions. That's called, in Latin, stare decisis. But it's brought down when it's a matter of interpreting the Constitution. Stare decisis has less of a role, because if a later Supreme Court feels the Constitution is against what the earlier court said, then the Constitution is greater than the earlier court. So, lahavdil, what I'm saying is, if a later Beis Din feels that Hashem in the Torah didn't mean what the earlier Sanhedrin said, so that would override the earlier Sanhedrin. Okay, so this is a very important Rambam, in which we differentiate between laws that are based on Drasha and laws that are based on Halacha L'Moshe Misinai. Laws that are based on Drasha, even a Sanhedrin of less esteem could be Mevatel, but a law that's based on Halacha L'Moshe Misinai cannot be set aside. So the question becomes, what type of law is the heter of marrying the Moabite female? So the simple pshat is it's a drasha, because the Chachamim made a drasha that the Torah says don't marry them because they didn't give you food and water. So it's only a man that is expected to give food and water and not a woman. That's a drasha. So Ploni Almoni knows this. Ploni Almoni is not so ignorant. He knows the drasha and he knows the heter. But here is what he says. You know, I know that I am allowed to marry a Moabite woman because the Sanhedrin of my generation, led by Boaz, says that it's permitted. But it's permitted based on their understanding of a pasuk, which is called a drasha. So I'm fine. I'm not committing any sin. But what's going to be if 50 years later, or 100 years later, or 200 years later, a later Sanhedrin says that drasha is incorrect? I will not have sins, but my children 200 years from now is going to have a taint. And indeed, Ploni Almoni is very prophetic, because we actually see Doe Koadomi in the time of David HaMelech brings up these very arguments and says, what do you mean it's not the derech of women to give food and water? Maybe women don't bring water to men, but they could have brought water to women. And he was actually slugging up the drasha. And they were going to passel David till Shmuel HaNavi said, this is a halacha L'Moshe Misina. So when Rashi says that the Goel made a mistake in the din of Amayni V'lo Amonis, it doesn't mean he thought that it was prohibited. He knew it was permitted, but he thought the source of the heter was a drasha, which could impugn his children later. But in fact, the source of the halacha is a halacha l'Moshe Mitzrayim. It's a tremendous word. And that makes Pliny Almoni much more of a lamdan than we would have assumed. But that's how the Brisker Rebbe understands the Shaka B'Tarya. And again, it fits a Gemara in Yevamah so perfectly. He bases it on that. Because Doei Ko'adomi, when he says, why is David allowed? He comes from Rus. And they told him, females are permitted. And he says, why is that? So first they wanted to say, well, because the Torah says Zachor and Anakeva. That's not valid. When it says Mamzer, it includes female. Second attempt was, well, it says because they didn't give food and water and women cannot be expected. It says, women can give to women. And they didn't have an answer to that until Shmuel said, Tach Mekublani, that the din is Halacha L'Moshe. Let me see. Actually, it wasn't Shmuel. Shmuel was not alive already, someone said, Kach mekublani mi beis Shmuel. I was makabel from Shmuel that this is halacha l'moshe misinai. And that is what the Goyel was afraid of. That is what he did not know. That was the point upon which he was ignorant.
But which was it? Actually,
yes. So the answer is, it is halacha l'moshe misinai, but it is alluded to in the drasha. But the drasha is not the source of the law. The source of the law is halacha l'moshe misinai. Yeah.
I thought that even by Yishai, there was already still a doubt.
Yeah, that's correct. Yishai separated from his wife because of that doubt. It did not. Yeah, apparently, it's hard to know the history of this. Apparently, until this final story with Doeg and David, it was not totally makubal that it was halacha l'moshe misinai, and not everybody knew. There were reasons mystically why Hashem didn't want that knowledge to be known, because David had to come from questionable origins. The whole idea in Kabbalah that David's origins are very tainted, and that's because the holiness of his soul could only come in under the radar, as it were. It had to be a sheep in wolf's clothing.
This goes back to the drasha. And he thought maybe the
dress
was wrong.
Yeah, that's right.
And I don't want to take that on.
That's correct. Obviously, that's correct. Yishai must have thought it was also a drasha, and the drasha might be wrong. Because if it would have been halacha l'moshe misinai, Yishai wouldn't have had his own problem. So that's...
That's
entirely true. I mean, the Brisker Rebbe's Mahalach is based on the fact that Tov did not express concern for his own Aveira. He only expressed concern for his children. That's what the Brisker Rebbe says. But I'll peep shot. What you're saying is very legitimate. I mean, one can certainly understand somebody tells you something is mutter, and you were living with at least the thought that this is questionable. So you might tell even a big rabbi, hey, you know, why don't you do it instead of me? Instead of telling me to do it, you know, you do it and the like. Of course, even pragmatically, Pliny Almoni's attitude might be, hey, if I do it, people aren't going to assume it's okay. If you do it, you know, people will take a precedent from it. Now, let me raise another question, though, a very, very interesting question. And that is, the story of Ruth begins with Mahlon and Chilion and Elimelech and Naomi. There is a famine, and they move to Moab. And there's a whole discussion, and of course what happens is Elimelech dies, and Mahlon and Chilion marry Moabite women, and they die, and Naomi is left with her two daughters-in-law. And the question is, of course, why did they die? So there are many, many different views. Either they died because they left Eretz Yisrael, and you're not supposed to leave Eretz Yisrael even in a time of famine, or they were punished because they were selfish and stingy in feed their madrega, Well, that's I'll get to that. The Gemara in Bava Basra does not mention that as a reason. The Gemara in Bava Basra mentions only the two reasons that they either committed the sin of leaving Eretz Yisrael, or they committed the sin of not wanting to help the poor people. They wanted to get away from the riffraff that needed them. Or their aveira was that they caused people to lose hope. Because what happens is, Elimelech was a leader in the community, and if he abandons the ship, right, if the captain jumps off the ship, then people think there's no hope, and that's very, very devastating. and the like. Now, Targum Yainasan, which is not really Targum Yainasan, but the Targum on Megillas Rus, says that their sin was they married non-Jewish women. Meaning to say, yes, you can marry a female Moabite, but only after she converts. They married before the conversion. So this is the question I wanted to discuss very briefly. When did Rus convert? When did Rus become Jewish? And there's a fundamental contradiction in the Megillah, which is reflected in a big machlokus among Chazal. The simple interpretation of the story is that Rus and Orpah were non-Jews, and Rus converted only after the death of Naomi, because that's why Naomi says to Rus and Orpah, I'm sorry, after the death of Mahlon Rechilion. That is why Naomi says, go home, go home, go home, because when someone wants to convert, you have to discourage them. And that is when Rus says, your God is my God, where you go, I will go, that's Kabbalah's mitzvahs, and all the many laws of conversion are learned. That would imply that what? That Rus and Orpah were non-Jews, and Orpah didn't convert, she went back to Moab, and Rus converted. And that is also what Targum Yainasan says, that Mahlon V'Chilion were punished because they married Nashim Nachriot, they married non-Jewish women. But there are a lot of problems with that. The big problem is, if indeed Mahlon married a non-Jewish woman, when Mahlon dies, even if Rus later becomes Jewish, there is certainly no mitzvah to perpetuate the memory of the deceased by a mitzvah of Yibam. Good, it's not mandatory Yibam because it's a cousin, not a brother, but still, a marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew is a nullity. It does not exist. If Rus was a non-Jew when she married Mahlon, and she didn't become a Jew until afterwards, why would there be any reason for Boaz to perpetuate the memory of Mahlon? It wouldn't work. There was no marriage to Mahlon. So that would suggest that there was a conversion. But if there was a conversion, I mean, Rus and Orpah would seem to be in the same boat, right? Because, I mean, it doesn't say Rus and Orpah are only different after after Elimelech's and Mahlon's Vichilion's death. Also, that would indicate there is a conversion. And of course, that would explain why the Gemara says the only sin of Mahlon V'Chilion was leaving Eretz Yisrael or being selfish, and it does not say intermarriage. But then the question becomes, why is Naomi encouraging Rus and Orpah to go back home if they're already Jewish? So you have what's called a Mimanav Shechdik Akasha here, and that is, if Rus and Orpah are not Jewish, why is there a concept of Yibam? There was no marriage. If Rus and Orpah are Jewish, then why is Naomi encouraging them to go home? So, Lemaisa, you have that contradiction in the Megillah. Let me just tell you, though, that it is a machlokas in Chazal. Rashi himself brings in Megillas Rus that Rus and Orpah were Nachrios. They were Goyim, Gemurim. Of course, Rashi doesn't answer the question, how could there be a concept of Yibam under those circumstances? And in fact, Rashi says this in a very ingenious, halachically complex way. Naomi, remember Naomi's line is, what's the use of you waiting? I'm an old woman, and even if I would become pregnant, I don't have a husband, but even if I would have a husband, and even if I would become pregnant tonight, are you going to wait until they're old enough to marry? Now, Rashi asks a halachic question. It's a very ingenious halachic question. What if they would have said, yeah, I'll wait 30 years. But they wouldn't have been allowed to marry anyway, because there's a rule by Yibam that a brother can marry the widow of his brother, if there are no children, only if the brother who died was alive in the life. In other words, if you're a brother that was born after the death of a brother, right? If a brother died and then you're born, then a brother is born, he cannot do Yibam. This is called Eishes Ach Shalo Haya Ba'olamo. The wife of my brother that was not in existence during my lifetime, it is prohibited to marry. So Rashi asked the Kasha, how could Naomi even entertain the possibility that if she would have a child and they wait long enough, they could get married? That would be the wife of a brother who predeceased the birth of another brother. So Rashi's answer is, it wouldn't be the wife of the brother, because Machlon was not married to Rus, and Chilion was not married to Orpah because they were Goyim, and therefore it would simply be marriage to an unrelated woman. In other words, the woman was not, right, the widow. So Rashi clearly learns that they were not married at all, because they were Nachriot. But the question becomes, why would there be a concept of Yiba? So I just want to mention a very interesting Zohar. This is the part of the Zohar that is called the Zohar Chadash. There is the regular Zohar, and there is what is called the Zohar Chadash. Now, the Zohar Chadash does not mean the new Zohar, because it's the same Zohar, whenever, but it simply means it was a part of the Zohar that was printed later than the earlier part of the Zohar. So although chronologically it may belong to the same tekufa, and I'm not going to address whether that's Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai or Moshe de Leon, that's another question. Moshe de Leon was the Spanish Kabbalist who allegedly discovered the Zohar in the 12th century.
Was it related to Ponce de Leon?
Well, it's the same name, you know, who knows. And there's an old controversy that goes back for quite a long time. Is the Zohar really the product of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai all the way back to the 1st and 2nd century? Or is it a product of Rav Moshe de Leon, which would make it a product of the 12th century? And most religious Jews follow the view that it is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and Rav Moshe de Leon is the discoverer of the manuscript. But there are eminent people like Rav Yaakov Emden and some Yemenite Talmidei Chachamim, Rav Kapach's grandfather, who took the position that the Zohar is, of course, it's still pretty early, but it's not, it doesn't go back to the Tanoim, it's from Moshe de Leon. I'm not, and of course, most academics, Lahavdil, feel the same way. I'm not addressing that controversy, but I'm just making a more modest claim that Zohar Chadash is no later than the Zohar Yashan, meaning it's just a question of when it was first printed. Now, the Zohar Chadash says a very interesting explanation, which really explains the narrative very, very well. He says, Avada is a Dover Pashat that Rus and Orpah converted, because Machlon Bechilion would not have married non-Jews. And that is why the Gemara does not condemn them for marrying non-Jews. The Gemara condemns them for leaving Eretz Yisrael, or it condemns them for taking away the courage of the population, or it condemns them for selfishness. The Gemara does not condemn them for intermarriage. Avada, they married Jewish women, or converted women. But here is the problem. The halacha is that when you're not supposed to accept converts in the days of Shlomo HaMelech and the like, because when Jews are living with great prosperity, you have to suspect at least that maybe the conversion is not sincere. So this is Naomi's problem. Naomi's problem is that when Rus and Orpah converted, remember, they came from a royal household, Eglon Melech Moab. They joined a family that was rich, that was influential, that was politically well connected. It was like the joining of a royal home. Naomi has doubts whether such a conversion was L'shem Shemayim. If it was L'shem Shemayim, it's valid. If it's not L'shem Shemayim, it's invalid.
Well, how can it be L'shem Shemayim if it's because they want to get become marriage? That alone is L'shem Shemayim.
So the test is, are you willing to stay with the Jewish people? Even when you're poor, even when you're alone, even when you've lost your husband, even when there's no property. So according to the Zohar Chadash, Rus is not converting now, but Naomi needs to know before she returns to Eretz Israel, was this a conversion for ulterior motives? Or was this a conversion L'shem Shemayim? Rus, who is willing to stay even though Naomi has no money And remember, she doesn't even know there's any connections. You know, she doesn't know about Boaz yet. If she's willing to stay with a poor, widowed woman who is all alone, that shows us not that she's becoming Jewish now. That shows us retroactively that her gerus was l'shem shamayim, meaning her marriage to Mahlon was a valid marriage. And that's why there's Yibam. Orpah, who, remember even the name, Orpah, Oreb, she turns her back. Orpah, if Orpah's willing to drop Naomi at this point, although, you know, for credit to Orpah, I think, you know, Orpah didn't stum, as I say, forget it. I mean, but Orpah was relatively easy to be dissuaded. So that shows her conversion was never valid. So according to the Zohar Chadash, the issue was Rus a non-Jew or a Jew? She underwent the conversion, but it was not clear that she was Jewish until her response afterwards, and that's what we call Igloi Milsa L'mafreya. We go backwards retroactively and we establish it. So that's a beautiful shot because that really reconciles the contradiction. On one hand, they underwent the conversion. On the other hand, Naomi has to see if they're sincere and sending them back. If Ruth stays, that means her conversion was sincere. Her marriage to Mahlon was a valid marriage. And if her marriage to Mahlon was a valid marriage, that is why there would be a concept of Yibam, because it was a valid marriage. Now one other thing I want to just clarify, that is, so basically Rashi says Naomi needs two transactions to be done. One is redeem her fields, and the other is marry Rus. And since Rashi understands that once the field would be sold, Naomi would have no control over who redeems it, so she couldn't say, oh, the only one who could redeem it is the one that marries Rus. That's why Rashi understands, machra, as I said before, does not mean she has sold her field, but machra means she is desirous of selling her field, but she will only sell her field to a relative if that relative will agree to marry Rus. Which means there is no halachic. See, this is where people sometimes get in error. According to Rashi's pshat, there is no halachic linkage between the two ideas. There's no halacha that says you can redeem the field only if you marry the woman. It's not a halachic linkage. It's simply the linkage that Naomi is artificially maintaining by basically saying, hey, you want the field? Well, this is what's going to cost you. You have to marry my daughter-in-law, Rus. So, because Ploni Almoni either didn't know the halacha, or like you're saying, he didn't want to take the responsibility for it, or like the Brisker Rav, he knew the halacha, but he thought it was a drasha instead of halacha Moshe Misinai, Ploni Almoni says, I decline. So, Boaz wanted a formal renunciation. He didn't just want verbal, because he didn't want Ploni Almoni to come in later and say, hey, you know, you took it away from me. So there was a ceremony of the removal of the shoe. So here's the thing I want to clarify. Most people read this, and since they know that we're talking about a type of yibam, so they assume that the removal of the shoe is connected to the ceremony of chalitza. That's a very logical assumption. And in fact, as a matter of literary device, chalitza is probably being alluded to, but this is not a ceremony of chalitza. Let me explain why this is so. Chalitza would require that the woman remove the shoe from the man who doesn't want to do yibam. Now here, it does not say Rus removed the shoe, right? It's between the two men. Moreover, let me point out that chalitza never applies if somebody's going to do yibam. If you have five brothers, and one brother says, I don't want to do yibam, and the other brother wants, you don't need chalitza. You only need chalitza when nobody wants to do yibam. So here, if there's another person who's going to do yibam, right? So there are two reasons why, I'll give you a third reason in a moment, there are two reasons why the shoe removal ceremony is not chalitza. Number one, there is no, the pasuk says, does not say that Rus removed the shoe, and chalitza would require Rus removes the shoe. Number two, since there is a man who wants to do Yibam, namely Boaz, there would be no need for Ploni Almoni to do Chalitza, because there is a Yibam. And number three, Lahalacha, the ceremony as described in the Gemara is that Ploni Almoni took the shoe off Boaz. Now, if it would be Chalitza, the guy whose shoe would be taken off is Ploni Almoni. So if it was not halachically chalitza, it is really a different thing. This is called a kinyan chalipin, and that is that one of the ways I transfer a right to you. If I want to transfer a right to you, so we have what is called symbolic barter. You give me a handkerchief, you give me a pen, you give me an object, and by your giving me an object, symbolically we've bartered. So the Gemara says that shoe was lav davka, that it could have been any object, but it was customary in those days that they would do chalipin. Chalipin means barter through a shoe. Why was that so? That's an interesting thing. Not because of chalitza, but because the sign of a free man was to have shoes. That's why the money that the brothers got from Mechiras Yosef, they bought shoes. A slave walked around barefoot, because the concept was, symbolically, that means you can't go where you want to go. So, when I sell something to you, I'm in your debt, so to speak, meaning I no longer own it, I'm subservient to you. So, symbolically, that would be represented by Boaz taking off his shoe, meaning to say, in exchange for your transferring something to me, I'm in your debt. I'm in your debt. So, the point is, although there are different opinions in the Gemara, the point to keep in mind about this is that what actually happened is, according to the Maskana of the Gemara, Boaz took off his shoe and he gave it to Ploni Almoni, and by giving Ploni Almoni something of Boaz, Ploni Almoni transferred to Boaz his right to do Yibam and his right to redeem the field. It was a transfer of rights through a formal Maisa Kinyan. Now, however, there's an important rule in Tanakh to be aware of, and that is, even if the underlying transaction had nothing to do with Chalitza, and it didn't, but the language is ambiguous enough that it conjures up in your mind the mental image of Chalitza, and that's important. Sometimes the language of Psukim is written in such a way to make you think of something. It's like a secondary association, even if that's not what the pasuk is talking about. Okay, there's a primary meaning, and there's a secondary association that is triggered in the mind by the words. And there is no question that chalitza is triggered by the description, and it's making the point that the one who doesn't want to do yibam is condemned and criticized. In fact, the Baal Shem Tov says a very powerful thought. Why is chalitza the removal of a shoe? Removal of a shoe is a sign of avelus. In fact, that's why those of you that may have had parents from Poland or Russia know that there was a tradition that they didn't like kids to walk barefoot in the house. I don't know, maybe modern parents are less machped on it, but there was a concept of an ayin hara that was connected to avelus and the like. And the Baal Shem Tov is saying a word that's very similar. He says, the woman takes off the shoe of the brother as if to say, you killed my husband the second time. My husband already died without children. You had a chance to perpetuate his life. You refuse to do so. Take off your shoes because you killed him again. That's what the Baal Shem Tov says. So there is a certain remez. So I think this is an important idea, that the language of Tanakh is often written to conjure up secondary associations, even if that's not what the pasuk itself is referring to. Okay, so that was just some stuff I wanted to talk about for Megillas Rus. Again, there are.